You know, folks, if you think about it, the word highlights is really kind of nonspecific and vague. And for the purpose of tonight's show, that's just the way we like it.
In a career spanning more than 30 years, David Letterman redefined the modern talk show with an ironic comic style that transcended traditional television. While he remains one of the most famous stars in America, he is a remote, even reclusive figure whose career is often widely misunderstood. In his new book, Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night, Jason Zinnemann, the first comedy critic in the history of the New York Times, mixes reporting with unprecedented access and critical analysis to explain the unique entertainer's titanic legacy. Moving from his early days in Indiana to his retirement, Zinnemann goes behind the scenes of Letterman's television career to illuminate the origins of his revolutionary comedy, its overlooked influences, and how his work intersects with and reveals his famously eccentric personality. Jason Zinnemann writes the On Comedy column for the New York Times, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Wonderful to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. I think, like you, one thing that we share is we're both very big David Letterman fans, and I think 10 years older than you are, but grew up in that generation. I was
right.
In college in the late 80s, and that was what you did. You watched David Letterman.
Right. That's exactly right.
And you did not realize, and I don't think I realized quite until really later on, of just how much an influence those years had on me.
Right. I think it's people have forgotten to a large extent how late 12:30 was in the 80s. It was later than 12:30 is right now. That right now at 12:30 at night, young people have limitless options. They could be streaming movies, they could be watching all kinds of reverent comedy. When we in the 80s, if you know, 1983, and you liked things that were a little bit irreverent, comedy a little irreverent, you were doing one thing. You were watching David Letterman. And that's why his impact, one of the reasons his impact is so enormous, because you know, this a whole generation of people grew up watching him and seeing this show that was totally different than what was on before it, both in its time slot and previously, you know, in previous years. And so it sort of established this vocabulary for talk shows that didn't exist before, and that lives on to this day.
You make the case in the book, and I mentioned this and alluded to in the introduction, that is misunderstood, and that you were concerned that impact could be forgotten.
Well, I mean, the reality is talk show hosts are always forgotten. I mean, that's one thing. Some sources tell me that when I said, they said, look, you're doomed. I mean, this is what happens to talk show hosts. They're not like painters or novelists. No one knows who Jack Parr is. No one knows who Steve Allen is. These are titanic figures in the history of television entertainment. They started something. They really started a form. Then even someone like Johnny Carson, who, you know, was arguably the biggest star in television for decades. A lot of his comedic and artistic legacy, I think, has been forgotten. You talk to people, talk about Johnny Carson today, they usually talk about his significance as a gatekeeper. He made this career. He was important. And Letterman, you know, his shows are harder to find than you'd think. Unlike Saturday Night Live or Seinfeld or The Simpsons or shows which are of equal influence and around that time, which can be are constantly shown on television and it can be seen in a kind of systematic way, you can't do that with Late Night, which is a real shame. So because of that, I mean, I worried that, you know, here's this guy who had a bigger impact than anybody, and yet, for a variety of reasons, that there's a chance that his legacy is forgotten or misunderstood. Because the other thing is, and this is one thing I wanted to do with the book, here's a guy who was on TV for 33 years, and his show changed a lot in those 33 years. And there's different incarnations of his show. And if you talk to someone who really knows, say, The Simpsons, they know that the first year of The Simpsons is very different than the third year of The Simpsons, which is very different than the 20th year of The Simpsons.
Right.
And to say The Simpsons is all one thing is absurd. I'm not sure Letterman fans, even diehard Letterman fans, have a great understanding of the difference between Letterman in 1984 and Letterman in 1986. But they're hugely different. And that's one of the things I wanted to map out in this book.
So let's talk about that, because you basically look at three periods in that time? Is that?
I look at the whole his whole career.
Well, you look at his whole career, but you break it up basically into sort of these three stages of that career.
There's, I mean, I think the kind of implicit and sometimes explicit argument of the book is that his greatest artistic periods are these three periods, which were in the first third of his first half of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, which starts really at his morning show in 1980 and goes through to 1984. And the next one is in the middle of the 80s. And then the last one is, sort of in the late 80s, 88. I sort of marked the writer's strike. There was a big writer's strike where he was away for 6 months. From then up to the CBS years is the next incarnation. Each three of these periods has a distinct aesthetic. In many cases, they're even though it's Letterman, it's Paul Shaffer, it's the same set, it's all this, they're that the writing staff changes, which has a huge impact, which is one of the things that I go into a lot in the book. I think most people, when they think of David Letterman's career, they break it up into his NBC years and his CBS years. And they say, and he used to be jumping on a Velcro wall, and then later on, he had a more traditional talk show. But what I discovered after going back and watching all the, that's the first thing I did was just rewatch all these shows, which is
want that job.
Yeah, exactly. Although it's hard, that's a lot of hours. That's 6,028. I didn't get through the whole thing.
Right. You said you started thinking I'm going to watch them all, and then
I realized this was a dumb idea. Yeah. This is I got through a lot. I got through thousands of hours, and I would say for the NBC years I'm close to exhaustive. But within those this really fertile era of the 80s and early 90s, his style really changes. In the early years, it's very literate and writerly, and there's all sorts of, it's really kind of in opposition to the talk show. It's really he's constantly reinventing what the talk show can be. He's changing the perspective. He's showing you, he's turning he's showing you the perspective from the back row. He has one show which he opens the back row. He's doing all this kind of weird stuff.
Which is the Meryl Marco influence, you argue, who was not only the co-creator of the morning show and late night, but also his girlfriend.
Yes. Meryl, I mean, I think the sort of one of the heroes of this book is, and unsung heroes, is Meryl Marco, that she was with him for 10 years when he was a stand-up. And it really was their collaboration. And they complimented each other, but they brought different things to the table. And it's really their collaboration that created what we know of as David Letterman. And what his sensibility was in the early years. And she had a huge impact, not only on, the sort of writerly aspect of it, and she had, but also she edited the early remotes and came up with a lot of the ideas, which really were the things that got the best reviews in the early, of the early show. And a lot of those remotes, I would put a direct line from those early remotes to Say What You See on The Daily Show. Or Conan. This idea of taking real life, going out into the street, taking interviews with unscripted interviews with real people, and cutting it into a comedy piece that's every bit as funny, if not more so, than scripting out a sketch. That comes from these incredibly creative remotes that were really the brainchild of Meryl Marco. And that continued to be a hallmark of the show for, through the 80s. So Meryl Marco has a huge hand in that early period. Then I think he has a period where he, the kind of Velcro wall period. And this is where his show becomes a little bigger, a little more influenced by Steve Allen. They're sort of stunts. And he also sort of it becomes visually more ambitious.
And he's also at the height of his popularity at this point.
Which is a key point. Yeah. A key point because, people are tuning in to see him. And his show sort of moves from something which is reacting to show business, making fun of talk shows, to something that also has its own weird conventions. Paul Shaffer's character, it gets filled out. Larry Budnell, that's when you have these really ambitious theme shows like Too Tired to Do a Show, where she does a show in his jeans up in the office, or a show where the camera moves around 360 degrees, or the monkey cam. Visually, this is Hal Gurney, the director, plays a huge role in all these cams, which make late night look like no other talk shows ever looked before. I mean, it really is. Talk shows used to be just shot like theater, And then Letterman came along in this period and just showed us a completely new version of what a talk show could be.
Hal Gurney becomes another hero in this book as somebody who came out of, who was directing Jack Paar, but came out of that, from that school, but really wanted to look at things incredibly differently, but also was very playful
yes.
in what he did.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's funny. Hal Gurney says that, you know, he was older than the rest of the people on the show.
Right.
He wasn't old, but he was older. And he had already had a you know, great career. And he, I think there was something about that position where he was willing to take chances as a director that others weren't. So he, I think, the, you know, it started in the morning show when he got hired. He would talk to Letterman, be this kind of disembodied voice on the show. And he would talk to Letterman and create this dynamic that was kind of a double act where Letterman would call him Hal Gertner.
Right.
And he was sort of this, Hal Gurney was kind of this weird authority figure who would annoy Letterman or he would make fun of him, and they went back and forth. And it was this dynamic that you really didn't have elsewhere. And it was a fascinating thing, and they played it out, and they became one of the many great double acts on that show. Letterman and Chris Elliott are another great double act. Letterman and Paul Schaefer, Letterman and... you know, even Barbara Gaines, who was a long-time employee and producer there, they had all one of the many things Letterman did, which now we sort of take for granted, is use the behind-the-scenes people to create a kind of cast of characters, a sort of family of characters that became, you know, critical parts of the comedy of the show.
One of the things that you write about in the book, and I was going to make a list, but the words regularly that come up are dark, seething, moody. Words, adjectives to describe David Letterman and his demeanor. He would become more insular. And as you point out, I think it was one thing that surprised me, being a fan and reading the book, was that this is what we started with. This was the baseline in many cases, because Meryl Marco and David Letterman would have regular fights as to, you know, you want to do this and I don't want to do that, and you're making me do things I don't want to do. And as you look at it, even as through the success of those years in the 80s on NBC, and then the big success of moving and making all the money and going to CBS, that he becomes even... I guess, I mean, weirder is a word, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that is, it's
sure.
a way to describe it. And
right.
and you see it really through, what I found fascinating is through the people you talk to, many of whom I've had wonderful conversations with, that have great admiration and deep love for the man, but also, A, would very rarely talk to him, and B, really went through the mill with him.
Right, right. I mean, let me just put a bit of context on this, which is that comedians, it's a cliche at this point, comedians
right.
are dark, right?
Right.
I mean, it's more likely than not, I cover comedy. Comedians, the difference in Letterman and a stand-up is that we saw him every single night.
Right. The torture, the misery that came out of his pores, perhaps more than it would be in a 90-minute set.
Exactly. And the fact, I mean, what I learned, you know, you knew as a viewer, at least, I think you could tell that he would turn the things he was irritated in and upset about into great comedy. And often it was mundane little things. And this is sort of the third period of Letterman. That's what a lot of the show was. It was kind of the theater of his difficult personality. Now, what I learned through reporting is that this wasn't an act, right? He, like many comedians, was often, you know, he often thought he was doing a terrible job. He always thought, you know, when I asked people who worked with him, you know, when was he happiest, there would often be a long pause, right? He was, you know, in many ways very neurotic, the way a lot of performers are. But what makes him great, what makes him a brilliant artist, is that he, as opposed to shutting off that neuroses, as opposed to compartmentalizing into just his private life, he found a way to express it on the show and turn it into comedy. And that's what artists do. And I think if you were a regular fan of Letterman, you saw that aspect of his personality. Now, if you worked for him, you have a different point of view on it. I mean, it's But to me, that dark side is integral to his greatness.
There's one anecdote that I love toward the end of the book where I think it's Barbara Gaines, but it may have been somebody else who was saying that there were toward the end of the show there were these postmortems, and he basically would keep people after the show, and they wouldn't talk about the show. He just didn't want to go home, and they said it didn't really turn into a postmortem; it turned more into a hostage situation.
Right.
I mean that says a lot.
Yeah. No, it's true. I think. It is true that, you know, there are writers there who worked there for many years who would barely meet him. You know, they've met him a few times. You know, and I think towards the end of the show, you know, he became more and more remote from his staff, from his writing staff. And I think he, in a lot of ways, you know, as I said, like he used his idiosyncrasies and put them on the show, and it served the show. And at times, especially towards the end, the show was sort of serving the idiosyncrasies. In that case, he was, you know, this is a tough part in his life, and he was, you know, having these postmortems to kind of not deal with his life.
So let's talk about the good stuff, which was what he accomplished when he was on the air.
I mean, 6,000 episodes. 6,028 episodes is a huge accomplishment. He created so many different forms of comedy that endure to this day, not just the remotes, but a whole style of delivery. I think one thing that is a big theme of this book is how influential the kind of David Letterman style of irony was. Mm. And it's both influential and at the same time, you don't see it in talk show hosts like you did back then. You know, Letterman, today the fashion is sort of more amiable, ingratiating, nice hosts, where Letterman was unafraid to be acerbic and sarcastic and to say something the opposite of what he meant. And one of the things that was really brilliant about him is how if you watched him enough and you figured out his tells, you could see what he was saying in all sorts of indirect ways. And so, you know, I think the kind of Letterman-esque irony was something that transcended talk shows. You know, I write a lot about in the book about how, you know, people like David Foster Wallace and Paul Rudnick and Spy Magazine, all these people cited Letterman as this person who kind of introduced this style of kind of meta comedy that now is everywhere.
They weren't always flattering in that.
Yeah. I mean, it was... You know, you saw it, then The Simpsons kind of took that mantle, and now it's just, you know, if you're on Twitter, it's everywhere, right? But it was, when he was doing it, it was, the way he kind of deconstructed the talk show was very unusual and very sort of, you know, path-breaking. So, I mean, I think that's a big part of his legacy, too. I think also if you look at, you know, his later career, you know, his response to 9/11 is... a huge, major accomplishment. No talk show host responded in a way that resonated with this country more, and I think was very cathartic for a lot of people, and was really galvanizing and showed off Letterman's emotional side, which you often didn't see. But in that moment, he was really working through the confusion that the whole country was. And I think, you know, when people look back at what he did, that will be a major moment.
He did get a major send-off. I mean, when he left, there was a reaction. I mean, I'll admit, I cried my eyes out.
Yeah.
And was lucky enough to be there for a couple of the last shows. But it was really, it was very profound for those of us who grew up in that time. You interviewed him, you talked to him for the book. Do you think he has any sense, even with the level of self-loathing that he has any sense of what he accomplished and created?
It's a good question. I mean, I think he does. He clearly does. I mean, I think he. I think it was hard for him to have that send off, where star after star was very emotional and sentimental. He is not a sentimental guy, obviously.
Right.
I think that was difficult, but I think he, at the end of I'm speculating to some degree, but I think he appreciated it and understood the magnitude of what happened. I think the relationship between the talk show host, the nightly talk show host, and the viewer is an intense, intimate one. If you're like us and you grew up watching this guy every night, you have it's a much more emotional relationship than with somebody in a stand-up comic who especially you see every couple years. And I think that's part of the reason also that him leaving was very emotional for people.
Last question, which is the subtitle of the book, The Last Giant of Late Night, which indicates we will never see someone like this again.
Yes, I struggled a bit with it. It's a bit definitive. I could be disproved, but I feel like I think that has as much to do with the fragmentation of the culture as it has to do with the exceptional and singular talent of David Letterman. I think we'll never see someone like Letterman again, but I think the way the culture is organized now, it's hard to imagine a figure who's both as innovative and as towering as him coming along again.
The name of the book is Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. It is published by Harper. Jason Zinnemann, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Terrific book. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
I had so much fun. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's go out onto 53rd Street and into Rupert G's Hello Deli, where you can get, simply dial that number, you get coffee or soda. Hello! Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming. Nice to see you. Good to have you.
What a bunch of losers. Good Lord.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.